sixth round and the 199th pick of the draft, the young quarterback's name was Tom Brady. He was fourth string at the beginning of his rookie season. By his second season, he was a starter. New England won the Super Bowl that year. Brady was named MVP. In terms of return on investment, it's probably the single greatest draft pick in the history of football. Four Super Bowl rings out of six appearances, 14 starting seasons, 172 wins, 428 touchdowns, three Super Bowl MVPs, 58,000 yards, 10 Pro Bowls, and more division titles than any quarterback in history. It's not even finished paying dividends. Brady may still have many more seasons left in him. So you'd think that the Patriots front office would be ecstatic with how it turned out. And indeed they were. They were also disappointed, deeply so, in themselves. Brady's surprising abilities meant that the Patriots' scouting reports were way off. For all their evaluations of players, they'd somehow missed or miscalculated all of his intangible attributes. They'd let this gem wait until the sixth round. Someone else could have drafted him. More than that, they didn't even know they were right about Brady until injuries knocked out Drew Bledsoe, their prize starter, and forced them to realize his potential. So even though their bets paid off, the Patriots honed in on the specific intelligence failure that could have prevented the pick from happening in the first place. Not that they were nitpicking or indulging in perfectionism, they had higher standards of performance to adhere to. For years, Scott Pioli, director of personnel for the Patriots, kept a photo on his desk of Dave Stachelski, a player the team had drafted in the fifth round, but had never made it through training camp. It was a reminder. You're not as good as you think. You don't have it all figured out. Stay focused. Do better. Coach John Wooden was very clear about this too. The scoreboard was not the judge of whether he or the team had achieved success. That wasn't what constituted winning. Bo Jackson wouldn't get impressed when he hit a home run or ran for a touchdown because he knew he hadn't done it perfect. In fact, he didn't ask for the ball after his first hit in Major League Baseball for that reason. To him, it was just a ground ball up the middle. This is characteristic of how great people think. It's not that they find failure in every success. They just hold themselves to a standard that exceeds what society might consider to be objective success. Because of that, they don't much care what other people think. They care whether they meet their own standards. And these standards are much, much higher than everyone else's. The Patriots saw the Brady pick as being more lucky than smart. And though some people are fine giving themselves credit for luck, they weren't. No one would say that the Patriots or any team in the NFL are without ego. But in this instance, instead of celebrating or congratulating themselves, they put their heads back down and focused on how to get even better. That's what makes humility such a powerful force, organizationally, personally, professionally. This isn't necessarily fun, by the way. It can feel like self-inflicted torture sometimes, but it does force you to always keep going and always improve. Ego can't see both sides of the issue. It can't get better because it only sees the validation. Remember, vain men never hear anything but praise. It can only see what's going well, not what isn't. It's why you might see egomaniacs with temporary leads, but rarely lasting runs of it. For us, the scoreboard can't be the only scoreboard. Warren Buffett has said the same thing, making a distinction between the inner scorecard and the external one. Your potential, the absolute best you're capable of, that's the metric to measure yourself against. Your standards are. Winning is not enough. People can get lucky and win. People can be assholes and win. Anyone can win. But not everyone is the best possible version of themselves. Harsh? Yes. The flip side of that is it means honestly being able to be proud and strong during the occasional defeat as well. When you take ego out of the equation, other people's opinions and external markers don't matter as much. That's more difficult, but ultimately a formula for resilience. The economist and philosopher Adam Smith had a theory for how wise and good people evaluate their actions. He said, There are two different occasions upon which we examine our own conduct and endeavor to view it in the light in which the impartial spectator would view it. First, when we are about to act, and secondly, after we have acted. Our views are apt to be very partial in both cases, but they are apt to be most partial when it is of the most importance that they should be otherwise. When we are about to act, the eagerness of passion will seldom allow us to consider what we are doing with the candor of an indifferent person. When the action is over, indeed, and the passions which prompted it have subsided, we can enter more coolly into the sentiments of the indifferent spectator. This indifferent spectator is a sort of guide with which we can judge our behavior, as opposed to the groundless applause that society so often gives out. Not that it's just about validation, though. Think of all the people who excuse their behavior, politicians, powerful CEOs, and the like, as not technically illegal. Think of the times you've excused your own with "no one will know." This is the moral gray area that our ego loves to exploit. Holding your ego against a standard, inner or indifferent or whatever you want to call it, makes it less and less likely that excess or wrongdoing is going to be tolerated by you. Because it's not about what you can get away with, it's about what you should or shouldn't do. It's a harder road at first, but one that ultimately makes us less selfish and self-absorbed. A person who judges himself based on his own standards doesn't crave the spotlight the same way as someone who lets applause dictate success. A person who can think long-term doesn't pity herself during short-term setbacks. A person who values the team can share credit and subsume his own interests in a way that most others can't. Reflecting on what went well or how amazing we are doesn't get us anywhere, except maybe to where we are right now. But we want to improve. We want more. We want to continue to improve. Ego blocks that, so we subsume it and smash it with continually higher standards. Not that we are endlessly pursuing more, as if we are racked with greed, but instead we're inching our way towards real improvement, with discipline rather than disposition. Always love. And why should we feel anger at the world, as if the world would notice? Euripides. In 1939, a young prodigy named Orson Welles was given one of the most unheard-of deals in Hollywood history. He could write, act, and direct in two films of his choosing for RKO, a major movie studio. For his first picture, he decided to tell the story of a mysterious newspaper baron who became a prisoner of his enormous empire and lifestyle. William Randolph Hearst, the infamous media magnate, decided that this movie was based on his life, and more importantly, that it did so offensively. He then began and initially succeeded in an all-consuming campaign to destroy one of the greatest films of all time. Here's what's so interesting about this. First, Hearst most likely never even saw the film, so he had no idea what was actually in it. Second, it wasn't intended to be about him, or at least solely about him. As far as we know, the character Charles Foster Kane was an amalgam of several historical figures, including Samuel Insull and Robert McCormick. The movie was also inspired by two similar portraits of power by Charlie Chaplin and Aldous Huxley, and it wasn't supposed to vilify, but to humanize. Third, Hearst was one of the richest men in the world at the time, and at 78, near the end of his life. Why would he spend so much time on something as inconsequential as a fictional movie by a first-time director? Fourth, it was his campaign to stop it that secured the movie's place in popular lore and made it clear the extent to which his drive to control and manipulate would go. Ironically, he cemented his own legacy as a reviled American figure far more than any critic ever could have. Thus, the paradox of hate and bitterness. It accomplishes almost exactly the opposite of what we hope it does. In the internet age, we call this the Streisand effect, named after a similar attempt by the singer and actress Barbara Streisand, who tried to legally remove a photo of her home from the web. Her actions backfired, and far more people saw it than would have had she left the issue alone. Attempting to destroy something out of hate or ego often ensures that it will be preserved and disseminated forever. The lengths that Hearst went to were absurd. He sent his most influential and powerful gossip columnist, Luella Parsons, to the studio to demand a screening. Based on her feedback, he decided that he would do everything in his power to block it from being made public. He issued a directive that none of his newspapers were to make any mention of any RKO film, the company producing Citizen Kane, period. More than a decade later, this ban still applied to Wells for all Hearst papers. Hearst papers began exploring negative stories about Wells and his private life. His gossip columnists threatened to do the same to each of RKO's board members. Hearst also made threats to the movie industry as a whole as a way of turning other studio heads against the picture. An $800,000 offer was made for the rights to the film so that it might be burned or destroyed. Most theater chains were pressured into refusing to show it, and no ads for it were allowed in any Hearst-owned properties. Hearst sympathizers began reporting rumors about Wells to various authorities, and in 1941, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI opened a file on him. The result was that the movie failed commercially. It took years for it to find its place in the culture. Only at great expense and with great exertion was Hearst able to hold it back. We all have stuff that pisses us off. The more successful or powerful we are, the more there will be that we think we need to protect in terms of our legacy, image, and influence. If we're not careful, however, we can end up wasting an incredible amount of time trying to keep the world from displeasing or disrespecting us. It is a sobering thought to consider for a moment all the needless death and needless waste inflicted over the eons by angry men or aggrieved women on other people, on society, and on themselves. Over what? Reasons that can hardly be remembered. You know what is a better response to an attack or a slight or something you don't like? Love. That's right, love. For the neighbor who won't turn down the music, for the parent that let you down, for the bureaucrat who lost your paperwork, for the group that rejects you, for the critic who attacks you, the former partner who stole your business idea, the bitch or the bastard who cheated on you. Love. Because as the song lyrics go, hate will get you every time. Okay, maybe love is too much to ask for whatever it is that you've had done to you. You could, at the very least, try to let it go. You could try to shake your head and laugh about it. Otherwise, the world will witness another example of a timeless and sad pattern. Rich, powerful person becomes so isolated and delusional that when something happens contrary to his wishes, he becomes consumed by it. The same drive that made him great is suddenly a great weakness. He turns a minor inconvenience into a massive sore. The wound festers, becomes infected, and can even kill him. This is what propelled Nixon forward and then sadly downward. Reflecting on his own exile, he later acknowledged that his lifelong image of himself as a scrappy fighter battling a hostile world was his undoing. He'd surrounded himself with other such tough guys. People forget that Nixon was re-elected by a landslide after Watergate broke. He just couldn't help himself. He kept fighting, he persecuted reporters, and he lashed out at everyone he felt had slighted or doubted him. It's what continued to feed the story and ultimately sank him. Like many such people, he ended up doing more damage to himself than anyone else could. The root of it was his hatefulness and his anger. And even being the most powerful leader in the free world couldn't change it. It doesn't need to be like that. Booker T. Washington tells an anecdote told to him by Frederick Douglass about a time he was traveling and asked to move and ride in the baggage car because of his race. A white supporter rushed up to him to apologize for this horrible offense. "I'm sorry, Mr. Douglass, that you have been degraded in this manner," the person said. Douglass would have none of that. He wasn't angry. He wasn't hurt. He replied with great fervor, "They cannot degrade Frederick Douglass. The soul that is within me no man can degrade. I am not the one that is being degraded on account of this treatment, but those who are inflicting it upon me." Certainly, this is an incredibly difficult attitude to maintain. It's far easier to hate. It's natural to lash out. Yet we find what defines great leaders like Douglass is that instead of hating their enemies, they feel a sort of pity and empathy for them. Think of Barbara Jordan at the 1992 Democratic National Convention proposing an agenda of love, 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 love. Think of Martin Luther King Jr. over and over again preaching that hate was a burden and love was freedom. Love was transformational, hate was debilitating. In one of his most famous sermons, he took it further. He said, "We begin to love our enemies and love those persons that hate us, whether in collective life or individual life, by looking at ourselves." We must strip ourselves of the ego that protects and suffocates us, because, as he said, hate at any point is a cancer that gnaws away at the very vital center of your life and your existence. It is like eroding acid that eats away the best and the objective center of your life. Take inventory for a second. What do you dislike? Whose name fills you with revulsion and rage? Now ask, have these strong feelings really helped you accomplish anything? Take an even wider inventory. Where has hatred and rage ever really gotten anyone? Especially because almost universally, the traits or behaviors that have pissed us off in other people, their dishonesty, their selfishness, their laziness, are hardly going to work out well for them in the end. Their ego and short-sightedness contains its own punishment. The question we must ask ourselves is, are we going to be miserable just because other people are? Consider how Orson Welles responded to the multi-decade campaign by Hearst. According to his own account, he bumped into Hearst in an elevator on the night of the movie's premiere, the very one that Hearst had deployed massive resources to prevent and destroy. Do you know what he did? He invited Hearst to come. When Hearst declined, Welles joked that Charles Foster Kane surely would have accepted. It took a very long time for Welles' genius in that movie to finally be acknowledged by the rest of the world. No matter, Welles soldiered on, making other movies and producing other fantastic art. By all accounts, he lived a fulfilling and happy life. Eventually, Citizen Kane secured its place in the forefront of cinematic history. 70 years after the movie's debut, it was finally played at Hearst Castle at San Simeon, which is now a state park. The events he endured weren't exactly fair, but at least he didn't let it ruin his life. As Welles' girlfriend of 20-plus years said in his eulogy, referring not just to Hearst, but to every slight he ever received in his long career in a notoriously ruthless industry, "I promise you it didn't make him bitter." In other words, he never became like Hearst. Not everyone is capable of responding that way. At various points in our lives, we seem to have different capacities for forgiveness and understanding. And even when some people are able to carry on, they carry with them a needless load of resentment. Remember Kirk Hammett, who suddenly became the guitarist in Metallica? The man they kicked out to make room for him, Dave Mustaine, went on to form another band, Megadeth. Even amidst his own unbelievable success, he was eaten up with rage and hatred over the way he'd been treated those many years before. It drove him to addiction and could have killed him. It was 18 years until he was able to begin to process it, and said it still felt like yesterday that he'd been hurt and rejected. When you hear him tell it, as he did once on camera to his former bandmates, it sounds like he ended up living under a bridge. In reality, the man sold millions of records, produced great music, and lived the life of a rock star. We've all felt this pain, and to quote his lyrics, smiled its black tooth grin. This obsession with the past, with something that someone did or how things should have been, as much as it hurts, is ego embodied. Everyone else has moved on, but you can't, because you can't see anything but your own way. You can't conceive of accepting that someone could hurt you, deliberately or otherwise. So you hate. In failure or adversity, it's so easy to hate. Hate defers blame. It makes someone else responsible. It's a distraction, too. We don't do much else when we're busy getting revenge or investigating the wrongs that have supposedly been done to us. Does this get us any closer to where we want to be? No. It just keeps us where we are. Or worse, arrests our development entirely. If we are already successful, as Hearst was, it tarnishes our legacy and turns sour what should be our golden years. Meanwhile, love is right there. Egoless, open, positive, vulnerable, peaceful, and productive. For all that comes next, ego is the enemy. I don't like work. No man does. But I like what is in the work, the chance to find yourself. Joseph Conrad. In William Manchester's epic biography of the life of Winston Churchill, the middle volume, a third of the set, is titled Alone. For a full 8 years, Churchill stood more or less by himself against his short-sighted peers, against the rising threat of fascism, even among the West. But eventually he triumphed again, and faced adversity again, and was vindicated again. Catherine Graham stood alone as she took over her family's newspaper empire. Her son, Donald Graham, must have felt similar pressure as he sought to preserve the company during the dramatic declines of the industry in the mid-2000s. Both made it through. So can you. There is no way around it. We will experience difficulty. We will feel the touch of failure. As Benjamin Franklin observed, those who drink to the bottom of the cup must expect to meet with some of the dregs. But what if the dregs weren't so bad? As Harold Jeanin put it, people learn from their failures, seldom do they learn anything from success. It's why the old Celtic saying tells us, see much, study much, suffer much, that is the path to wisdom. What you face right now could, should, and can be such a path. Wisdom or ignorance, ego is the swing vote. Aspiration leads to success and adversity. Success creates its own adversity and hopefully new ambitions. And adversity leads to aspiration and more success. It's an endless loop. All of us exist on this continuum. We occupy different places on it at various points in our lives. But when we do fail, it sucks. No question. Whatever is next for us, we can be sure of one thing we'll want to avoid. Ego. It makes all the steps hard, but failure is the one it will make permanent, unless we learn, right here and right now, from our mistakes. Unless we use this moment as an opportunity to understand ourselves and our own mind better, ego will seek out failure like true north. All great men and women went through difficulties to get to where they are. All of them made mistakes. They found within those experiences some benefit, even if it was simply the realization that they are not infallible and that things would not always go their way. They found that self-awareness was the way out and through. If they hadn't, they wouldn't have gotten better and they wouldn't have been able to rise again, which is why we have their mantra to guide us so that we can survive and thrive in every phase of our journey. It is simple, though, as always, never easy. Not to aspire or seek out of ego. To have success without ego. To push through failure with strength, not ego. Epilogue. There is something of a civil war going on within all of our lives. There is a recalcitrant south of our soul revolting against the north of our soul. And there is this continual struggle within the very structure of every individual life. Martin Luther King, Jr. If you're listening to this right now, then you have made it through this book. I was afraid some people might not. To be perfectly honest, I wasn't sure I'd ever get here myself. How do you feel? Tired? Confused? Free? It's no easy task to go head-to-head with one's ego, to accept first that ego may be there, then to subject it to scrutiny and criticism. Most of us can't handle uncomfortable self-examination. It's easier to do just about anything else. In fact, some of the world's most unbelievable accomplishments are undoubtedly a result of a desire to avoid facing the darkness of ego. In any case, just by making it to this point, you've struck a serious blow against it. It's not all you need to do, but it is a start. My friend, the philosopher and martial artist Daniele Bolelli, once gave me a helpful metaphor. He explained that training was like sweeping the floor. Just because we've done it once doesn't mean the floor is clean forever. Every day the dust comes back, Every day we must sweep. The same is true for ego. You would be stunned at what kind of damage dust and dirt can do over time, and how quickly it accumulates and becomes utterly unmanageable. A few days after being fired by the American Apparel Board of Directors, Dev Charney called me at 3 a.m. He was alternately despondent and angry, genuinely believing himself to be totally blameless for his situation. I asked him, "What are you going to do? Are you going to pull a Steve Jobs and start a new company? Are you going to make a comeback?" He got quiet and said to me with an earnestness I could feel through the phone and in my bones, "Ryan, Steve Jobs died." To him, in this addled state, this failure, this blow was somehow the same as death. That was one of the last times we ever spoke. I watched with horror in the months that followed as he wreaked havoc on the company he had put everything into building. It was a sad moment and one that has stayed with me. But for the grace of God go I, but for the grace of God, that could be any of us. We all experience success and failure in our own way. Struggling to write this book, I went through 4 hard-fought but rejected drafts of the proposal and dozens of drafts of the manuscript. On my earlier projects, I'm sure the strain would have broken me. Maybe I would have quit or tried to work with someone else. Maybe I would have dug in my heels to get my way and irreparably damaged the book. At some point during the process, I came up with a therapeutic device. After each draft, I would tear up the pages and feed the paper to a worm compost I kept in my garage. A few months later, those painful pages were dirt that nourished my yard, which I could walk on with bare feet. It was a real and tangible connection to that larger immensity. I like to remind myself that the same process is going to happen to me when I'm done, when I die and nature tears me up. One of the most freeing realizations came to me while I was writing and thinking about the ideas in the pages you've just listened to. It occurred to me what a damaging delusion this notion that our lives are grand monuments set to last for all time really is. Any ambitious person knows that feeling, that you must do great things, that you must get your way, and that if you don't, that you're a worthless failure, and the world is conspiring against you. There's so much pressure that eventually we all break under it or are broken by it. Of course, that is not true. Yes, we all have potential within us. We all have goals and accomplishments that we know we can achieve, whether it's starting a company, finishing a creative work, making a run at a championship, or getting to the top of your respective field. These are worthy aims. A broken person will not get there. The problem is when ego intrudes on these pursuits, corrupting them and undermining us as we set out to achieve and accomplish. Whispering lies as we embark on that journey, and whispering lies as we succeed in it, and worse, whispering painful lies when we stumble along the way. Ego, like any drug, might be indulged at first in the misguided attempt to get an edge or to take one off. The problem is how quickly it becomes an end unto itself, which is how one finds themselves in surreal moments like the one I experienced on the phone with Dove, or in any of the cautionary tales in this book. In the course of my work and my life, I found that most of the consequences of ego are not quite so calamitous. Many of the people in your life and in our world who have given over to their ego will not get what they deserve in the sense of karmic justice that we're taught to believe in as kids. I wish it were so simple. Instead, the consequences are closer to the ending of one of my favorite books, What Makes Sammy Run, by Bud Schulberg, a novel whose famous character is based on the real lives of entertainment entrepreneurs like Samuel Goldwyn and David O. Selznick. In the book, the narrator is called to the palatial mansion of a calculating, ruthless, egotistical Hollywood mogul whose precipitous rise he has followed with a mix of admiration and confusion and eventually disgust. In this moment of vulnerability, the narrator catches a true glimpse into the man's life, his lonely, empty marriage, his fear, his insecurity, his inability to be still even for a second. He realizes that the vengeance, the bad karma he'd hoped for all the rules the man had broken, all the cheating ways he had gotten ahead, wasn't coming, because it was already there. As he writes, I had expected something conclusive and fatal, and now I realized that what was coming to him was not a sudden payoff, but a process. A disease that he had caught in the epidemic that swept over his birthplace like a plague. A cancer that was slowly eating him away. The symptoms developing and intensifying. Success, loneliness, fear. Fear of all the bright young men, the newer, fresher Sammy Glicks that would spring up to harass him, to threaten him, and finally overtake him. That's how ego manifests itself. And isn't that what we're desperately afraid of becoming? I'll reveal one last thing I hope will make this come full circle. I first read that passage when I was 19 years old. It was reading a sign by a seasoned mentor who had found, as I would, early success in the entertainment business. The book was influential and informative for me, just as he'd known it would be. Yet over the next few years, I worked myself into a nearly identical situation as the characters in the book. Not just summoned to the palatial home to watch the expected and unavoidable dissolution of a person I admired, but to find myself dangerously close to my own shortly thereafter. I know the passage struck me because when I went to type it up for this epilogue, I found in my original copy pages covered in my own handwriting, written years before, detailing my reaction right before I had set out into the world. Clearly, I had understood Schulberg's words intellectually, even emotionally, but I had made the wrong choices anyway. I had swept once and thought it was enough. 10 years after first reading it and writing down my thoughts, I was ready once more. Those lessons came home to me in exactly the way I needed them to. There's a quote from Bismarck that says, in effect, any fool can learn from experience. The trick is to learn from other people's experience. This book started around the latter idea, and to my surprise, ended with a painful amount of the former as well. I set out to study ego and came crashing into my own, and to those of the people I had long since looked up to. It may be that you'll need to experience some of that on your own, too. Perhaps it is like Plutarch's reflection that we don't so much gain the knowledge of things by the words, as words by the experience we have of things. In any case, I want to conclude this book with the idea that has underpinned all of what you've just heard. That it's admirable to want to be better businessmen or businesswomen, better athletes, better conquerors. We should want to be better informed, better off financially. We should want, as I've said a few times in this audiobook, to do great things. I know that I do. But no less impressive an accomplishment, being better people, being happier people, being balanced people, being content people, being humble and selfless people, or better yet, all of these traits together. And what is most obvious but most ignored is that perfecting the personal regularly leads to success as a professional, but rarely the other way around. Working to refine our habitual thoughts, working to clamp down on destructive impulses, these are not simply the moral requirements of any decent person. They will make us more successful. They will help us navigate the treacherous waters that ambition will require us to travel. And they are also their own reward. So here you are, at the end of this book about ego, having seen as much as one can be shown about the problems of ego from other people's experiences and my own. What is left? Your choices. What will you do with this information? Not just now, but going forward. Every day for the rest of your life, you will find yourself at one of three phases: aspiration, success, failure. You will battle the ego in each of them. You will make mistakes in each of them. You must sweep the floor every minute of every day, and then sweep again. What should you read next? For most people, bibliographies are boring. For those of us who love to read, they can be the best part of an entire book. Obviously, with an audiobook, it's impossible to have a bibliography. The extensive bibliography that I created for this book was actually too long to fit in the print edition as well. So I've created a digital version that I'd like to send to you directly in fully clickable and searchable form that recommends all of the books that went into producing this book, how I found out about them, and which ones I strongly recommend that you read next. If you'd like these recommendations, all you have to do is email books@egoistheenemy.com or visit egoistheenemy.com/books. I will also send you a collection of my favorite quotes and observations about ego, many of which I couldn't fit in this book. Can I get even more book recommendations? You can also sign up for my monthly book recommendation email. The list of recipients has grown to more than 55,000 rabid, curious readers like yourself. You'll get one email per month with recommendations from me based on my own personal reading. The list also kicks off with 10 of my favorite books of all time. Just email ryanholiday@gmail.com with reading list email in the subject line or sign up at ryanholiday.net/reading-newsletter. Thank you. That concludes Ego is the Enemy, audiobook edition. Written by Ryan Holiday, narrated by Ryan Holiday. Copyright 2016, Ryan Holiday. Production copyright 2016 by Tim Ferriss Audio.
Ryan, good to be chatting.
Yeah, it's good to be talking.
It has been a little while since we've done this in the public forum, and I think about you every morning, and there's a very specific reason for that. I went to a hotel recently on the East Coast, and it turns out they provide quotes to people who are checking in, so they'll leave a quote on the bedside table or something like that. And the quote that was on the bedside table, I kept with me and actually taped it to my refrigerator, which is, you may recognize this, when jarred unavoidably by circumstance, revert at once to yourself and don't lose the rhythm more than you can help. You'll have a better grasp of harmony if you keep going back to it. And of course, that's Marcus Aurelius.
It's one of my favorites.
It is a spectacular quote, and it makes me think of your tattoos. And I'm not sure everyone listening is familiar with your tattoos, probably not. So as it relates to those with maxims, what do you have written on your body?
So I just have two, and it's going to seem somewhat self-indulgent, but I'll say the tattoos came first and the books came second, right? So I have "The Obstacle is the Way" tattooed on my left forearm, which is the title of the first book that you and I did together. And that's a derivation of a Marcus Aurelius quote, this idea of the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. And then there's the Zen saying, you know, the obstacle is the path. And then in late 2014, I got Ego is the Enemy, which then became the title of the book. But to me, I think in almost every situation, those two reminders either help calm you down, prevent you from doing something stupid or boneheaded, or give you, I would say, like some sort of dose of optimism that it doesn't really matter what's going on or how bad it is. I can get through it. You know, I look at those when I wake up. I love looking at them when I go swimming, when I go running. I see them every day, and they remind me of those two really important ideas.
And I guess I haven't developed the stomach for the ink just yet on the skin, so I'm settling for the refrigerator. But I'm glad you clarified that the tattoos came first and the books came second, because otherwise I was thinking to myself, it's going to be great when you have kids and start writing children's books.
Yeah.
The tattoos that you'll end up on your body.
Well, it's like, you know, I wrote a book on growth hacking that I'm not going to put that on my body anytime soon.
You're not going to get a tramp stamp with growth hacking on it?
Yeah, exactly.
So sorry guys, I've had a lot of tea today, but the very beginning of Ego's the Enemy opens up with you witnessing and in a way being involved with the very public implosion of American Apparel, right? And then having, in effect, a meltdown of your own. Can you talk about that and how Stoicism figured into that or didn't, like when the rubber hit the road? I mean, I'd just love to hear you explain the circumstances for people.
Yeah. And it's a somewhat tough situation because, as you know, anytime there's millions of dollars involved, there's certain confidentiality agreements and things like that. And the short of it is, in 2014, Doug Charney, who was my mentor, he was a close friend of mine, was fired by the board of directors at American Apparel. And he did not take that news well, as I imagine most people would not. And it turned into a hostile takeover. It was a very contentious time. And I'd been called in as a consultant to help with the turnaround of the company. And
called in by Dove or by the board?
By the board. So, you know, immediately that put me at odds with someone who I'd been close to for a very long time and looked up to and admired. But at the same time, I was able to see the situation a bit more objectively than he was. You know, I didn't view it as a betrayal. I sort of viewed it as a commitment to the company to which I had worked for a very long time and done a lot of work that I was proud of and had a lot of friends and colleagues, and there's great people there. And so the obstacle is the way it just come out. You know how it is. After you put out a book, you go on book tour, and you're just looking forward to the day where that all ends. 2 days after it ended is when I got the call. And so.
No rest for the wicked, I guess.
No, and so, I immediately found myself back living in Los Angeles while my future wife was in Austin. You know, I'm living in an Airbnb. I'm working constantly. I've got another book that I have to fit. I basically completely overcommitted myself to what became a total chaotic nightmare of conflict and intrigue and backstabbing and, you know, all the stuff that one would imagine would be going on in a hostile takeover of a company where the founder had been unceremoniously ejected. And I don't want to say I had a nervous breakdown, but I realized that I've always in my life been able to take on more and more stuff. Like every time an opportunity comes up, I've been able to jump on it. I'd never felt like, okay, that's overreaching, right? This is when I finally hit that wall and my relationship hit that wall. My sort of personal happiness hit that wall. You know, I was as tense as a human being could possibly be. I wasn't sleeping. It was just one of the worst periods of my life. And not only was I dealing with, you know, watching someone I'd looked up to behave in these ways that I didn't agree with and looking at the consequences of some of his behavior and being forced to say, is that what I want to be like? Is this the right thing to do? And then also having to look at, you know, this idea of like, why do I keep unthinkingly plunging myself into situations because I can't say no to money? I can't say no to the thrill of a chaotic situation. I can't say, hey, that's a great opportunity, but it's not for me. And so I hit this complete wall, and I eventually ended up walking away, you know, amicably from the board when they decided to go in a different direction before ultimately going back in the other direction. And I had to read.
What were the directions that they were thinking about going in?
So, you know, they reconsidered bringing him back on, and then they decided against it, and then ultimately the company was forced to declare bankruptcy and is now privately held. The company was in very dire straits, and the conflict was ultimately, I don't want to say fatal, but it put it on life support from which it's not clear that it will recover. And I hope it does, but you know, Dove walked away with nothing. Employees like myself who had stock options and had bought shares in the company, we lost everything. The board lost their share. So it was the definition of what became a lose-lose situation, and which, you know, I talk a little bit about in the book, this idea of when bad stuff happens, ego is what makes us make it worse because we can't step away. And ironically, Dove has now started his own company. It's interesting to think how different things would have been if he'd done that in 2014. What I took away from it ultimately when I finally got back to my actual life, it was like, you know, I carved out a career for myself, which was as a writer, which very few people can do, which I'd always wanted to do, which is what makes me happy. And then someone dangled something shiny over here and I jumped into it unthinkingly and in a very real way risked all of it because I wasn't able to really decide what was important to me and what mattered. You know, and I think a lot of people find themselves in situations like that where you wake up one day and you're like, what am I doing here?
I think probably everyone listening has found themselves in that situation multiple times, but I want to go back to you walking away from the board and I guess issuing that resignation or however it came down to it. But that day, there were all these cumulative stresses, and we've known each other quite a while. I mean, we both like to kind of step up to bat and take on a lot when we're in these various projects where we get a very cool opportunity dangled in front of us or something we think is cool at the time. And the question I have is, was there a defining moment or conversation or incident, realization, whatever it might have been, you know, what was the moment or the day in which the straw was added that broke the camel's back, where you decided, like, enough is enough, okay, I'm going to walk?
So, and I'm not sure what I can say. I'll say this. One thing that I'm glad I did, and I think I probably learned this from you and some of the stuff you're talking about. When you negotiate a contract, you want to think about these things in advance, right? You want to know, like, you want to have a ripcord in a contract that says, like, Hey, if this happens, we're walking away. And you have to be prepared to do that. And so I was in a position where when we started to have some philosophical disagreements about how things should go, you know, I was able to say, we've already addressed this contingency. It's time for my buyout to come into effect, right? Yeah. So I'm glad I did that. I think there was a couple moments, you know, I believe my computer had been hacked at one point. I was very nervous about that. You know,
how's your computer hacked by?
I won't say. It was just, I was starting to worry about my own personal security and safety. And it's like, there's nothing in business that is ever worth that, right? If I'm being perfectly honest, it was less about the situation and more about who I become when I get drawn into situations like that. Like, I remember one day I got to travel back and forth, commute back and forth from my home on occasion. So I was back in Austin, and I'd come home and I'd written all these emails on the plane, and I was waiting to get to my house so they would all send when I got Wi-Fi. And I got home and the internet was down, like Time Warner, which is horrible, wasn't working. And it wasn't working, and I was freaking out. Like, I had a legitimate panic attack that I couldn't send these totally meaningless emails at like 11 p.m. on a Friday, right? And like, this is deadly serious to me, and my wife is looking at me like I'm an insane person, and I'm acting like an insane person, and I'm taking it out on myself and on her and on the person in front of us when we're driving to go to Starbucks to get internet. You know, like, I'm behaving like an obscene monster, basically. And, you know, after I calmed down, it's like, none of this matters. Like, what am I doing? And so the situation was chaotic and stressful, and I'm glad that I'm not in it. But what I've learned about myself most of all is, you know, it's like, look, some people can drink an unlimited amount and not become an alcoholic, and other people, you know, they have one drink and they become somebody totally different. And I'm that way with stress and chaos. And so I realized in retrospect, like, I'm heading down a very bad road if I choose stress and chaos over the things that I've worked really hard to achieve in life and that I claim to be important to me. You know, like, I think a lot of people face that sort of fork in the road. It's like, you know, are you going to choose a life, or are you going to choose some career or financial or, you know, sort of, you know, accomplishment? And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. And I think the wake up call for me was, this is just not the person that I want
to
be.
I mean, not to throw a really hackneyed cliche out there, but I mean, the fork in the road that is, am I working in order to live, or am I living in order to work, right? And what does the hierarchy of priorities look like? And in your personal journey, I'd like to dig into one, which is the decision not to live in places that you're very familiar with, like LA, you know very well, San Francisco, New York City. Where do you live at the moment? And what's the story with the two miniature donkeys?
Yeah, I mean, I've lived in New York. I've lived in Los Angeles for a long time. Now I live right outside Austin. My wife and I, we have a small ranch. I mean, we have goats, we have miniature donkeys, we have longhorn cattle, and then like geese and chickens and a dog and stuff like that. Actually, what helped make to go back to your other question, what helped make this clear is, it's like, here I am living in somebody else's apartment in Los Angeles, and I'm flying home. I still lived in the city then, but I'm flying home to Austin, and it's like, this is my life. These are where my books are. This, like, I picked to live in Austin because I loved Austin, and here this job, which is not even my full-time job, is just a, you know, this thing is pulling me away from that. And I think that tells me something right there. But I remember I would come home. I was looking at my goats one day. They were in the front yard and they were just sort of standing there. And
I feel like goats do that a lot.
Yeah, they do. They weren't eating. They weren't, you know, headbutting each other. They weren't jumping on stuff. They were just standing there. And I remember thinking like, they're just being goats. Like they don't have a job. Like there's nothing that they're supposed to be doing. You know, they're just being alive. And that reminded me of something that I'd read, you know, in this, all this chaos. I'd actually started attending Workaholics Anonymous meetings when I was in Los Angeles. And, you know, they say this thing in the meetings, it's like that it's human being, not human doing. And it's like, yeah, the goat is just supposed to be alive. And here I've told myself that my job is to manage this crisis that I didn't create, that it's impossible for me to actually solve, to make other people lots of money. You know, like, is this what I was put on this earth to do, to be a bundle of stress and angry, you know, nerves? Like, of course not.
When did you decide on the farm? Is that something that, well, actually, let me rewind, because Workaholics Anonymous is not something I have any real familiarity with. And what else helped you from that experience, or did you take away, or that you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I took away a lot. This idea that your life can become unmanageable because you can't prioritize properly and that you can't take care of yourself and that you can, I mean, we don't associate, you know, sort of stress and heart attacks and, you know, and we don't associate those things with work because, you know, work is considered a good thing. And we don't see that it can become essentially a drug for people. It can become a thing that, like, if you think about it this way, let's say you're having a terrible day. All these things are going wrong. You know what always goes right? Like you sitting down at your computer, sending emails, or if you're good at what you do, work is the most predictable, safe, manageable thing in your life because like you control it in a lot more than you control other people or the weather or all these things, right? So I think for me, I could just plug into it in the way that somebody else might be able to turn on the television and tune out. I could just plug into it. And so it was this sort of an awareness of that. And then I had this awakening, you know, tied to the book, this idea that like, hey, I'm not building this like monument for all time. The world is not revolving around this ridiculous project that I'm, you know, working on, and that I'm the one that's making this feel urgent and essential and more important than anything else. I've brought that to the situation. And so I think that was a big thing I took. The other thing I took is, and I don't think people realize this because they hear workaholism, but they don't realize that it's really the activity that's the addiction. So there's lots of people who don't work a lot, or maybe they are financially secure so they don't, but you can be an activity addict too. And I certainly picked that up from my family. You know, my parents are always doing things. Like they live in Hawaii, but they're always doing things. And I think I internalized that as a young kid. It's like, I can't relax. Like I can't stop. And it was that impulse that had gotten me into this situation that I then couldn't figure out how to get out of. And the only way to get out of it was to walk away.
You walk away.
Yeah.
Now, do you still go to Workaholics Anonymous meetings?
I found it very hard to relate to a lot of the people in the thing, mostly being young. There's calls that you can call into.
Meaning you were younger than they.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was 27 at the time. There's not a lot of 27-year-olds in Workaholics Anonymous. There's calls that you can do. I go to a therapist who sort of specializes in this stuff. And it's also hard, you know, like, I know I just sort of told this harrowing story, but the consequences for me were like very low for all of this, right? Like I didn't destroy my relationship. I didn't, you know, bet all my money on some, you know, ridiculous venture. You know, I was in a great spot. I just committed to too much. So it wasn't like I was looking at the wreckage of my life. I was peering over the precipice of what could be the wreckage of my life. So obviously I read everything I could on the topic, and then I go to a therapist now who sort of specializes in this stuff and is sort of very familiar with the teachings of that community. So I feel like I sort of do it that way. But, you know, to go to your question about the decision to live in Austin, to live outside the city, to run my business and my life a certain way are in a huge part just eliminating a lot of the temptations and influence that would come from having an apartment in downtown Manhattan and a bustling marketing firm that is constantly creating fires that I have to put out.
Yeah. Well, I think that the where of happiness is really under-examined, and the tendency for type A personalities, I think I'm guilty of this or have been, and maybe you have at some point, is that I should be where the maximum number of opportunities are, often very ill-defined or poorly defined, this like broad opportunity bucket, and then I should have the self-control to stave off all of these impulses with these various temptations, whether it's booze, sure, late nights out, people who end up in New York and have never done cocaine and then end up doing cocaine socially because they work in an investment bank and A, B, C, D, and E happens. And I feel like that is wasteful in some respects, meaning that if you're smart, you should be able to create opportunities as opposed to being 100% reactive, although there's maybe that's easier after a certain age. And secondly, that so you don't suffer from like decision fatigue constantly and then make really bad big decisions, to choose a location where you don't have to constantly protect yourself from impulses to reach out and respond to some shiny distracting object or person or substance. And, you know, for me, San Francisco is the right fit. And for you, it sounds like Austin was the right fit. But let's look at, to rewind the clock just a little bit and talk about The Obstacle is the Way. So The Obstacle is the Way comes out and a few things happen. I mean, many things happen that I think are very interesting. One of them is how quickly it was picked up, or widely, I should say, it was picked up in the professional sports world. And there's a big piece in Sports Illustrated about this, but let's start with the Patriots, and then maybe you can just give a couple of anecdotes about how it spread, and then why you think it spread.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Obstacle is the Way came out almost exactly 2 years ago, so we would have been recording this a little bit before that. The book came out, and it was very much because of the audiobook. The audiobook, I guess people in sports love audiobooks because they travel a lot and their readers are always looking for an edge. But because of it, I know it was your podcast and it was also Shane Parrish, who runs Farnham Street. He'd written something about the book. Like, the book got very little media attention, but because of outlets like those two, a couple different people in the sports world picked it up. And one of them was Michael Lombardi, who's a special assistant for the New England Patriots, who's formerly the general manager of the Cleveland Browns. And he read the book and he just started giving it to other people. He emailed me a couple months later, but unbeknownst to me, he'd just given it to other people. And he and I had started talking. I sent him some more books. And then the Patriots ended up, and I'm not taking credit for this in any way, but the Patriots won the Super Bowl that year. And it was so amazing for me to be watching the Super Bowl and knowing that some of the people involved in that had read my book. But other than that, it was a total secret. Like, no one had talked about it, anything. And then the following offseason, Mike saw John Snyder, who's the general manager of the Seahawks, who the Patriots had beaten at a tryout, and he recommended the book to him. And so then the Seahawks read it, and it went through that organization. And so now all of a sudden my book has been read by both teams who were in the previous year's Super Bowl, and from there it just sort of caught on, not publicly, but by word of mouth. I heard from other players in the NFL, like Garrett Gilkey, who plays for the Bucks. And then it started making its way through baseball, then college sports in basketball, Shaka Smart, who became the coach of UT, George Raveling, who was a Hall of Fame coach. He coached at USC. He actually owns Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And now he's the director of basketball for Nike. So it just...
That's gotta be a tough one to enforce.
Yeah.
Like, do you actually chase people down or using the I Have a Dream to like inspire their students?
No. Like, he owns... So he was a bodyguard for Martin Luther King on the day he gave the I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And when he left, there's an amazing article about this. George just asked him if he could have the speech that Martin Luther King had read.
He owns the original.
He owns the actual day of.
It's
one of the most like sort of amazing historical bits of circumstance ever. And he has it in his, I mean, I don't know where he has it, but he has it. And it's so, I mean, just the
in his silverware drawer.
Yeah, right. I assume it's framed and under, you know, 10 feet of glass like the U.S. Constitution. But, so it had just made its way through sports and I started, arming.